Welcome back to Dakota Midday. On December 7th, 1941, 353 Japanese planes launched their attack on American naval forces in Hawaii. The American military, the American nation, was unprepared. Today, on the 75th anniversary of the attack, we begin by remembering some numbers. 2,403 U.S. personnel were killed that day, 1,178 wounded. The USS Arizona still rests on the seafloor in Pearl Harbor under 40 feet of water. Nearly 1,000 servicemen remain entombed inside its hull. The Arizona was hit by a 1,760-pound Japanese bomb, igniting 180,000 gallons of aviation fuel, 500 tons of gunpowder, more than 1 million pounds of munitions. The USS Arizona continues to leak 5 to 8 quarts of oil daily. We begin our conversation today by listening to history. In 2000, SDPB-TV produced South Dakota Stories, Pearl Harbor Survivors. At that time, there were just 19 members left in the South Dakota Pearl Harbor Survivors Association. SDPB's Steve Zwemke gathered a montage of comments from these interviews. It's difficult to reflect the magnitude of the day in this short piece, but here are voices of those who lived it and courageously fought through it.
We were getting some restrictions because of what was happening in the Pacific. I was in the Pacific Theater on the USS California battleship, and we could not have liberty and get out of the area. We had to, and we were had to be within 24 hours of the ship. And because we were kind of the politicians were doing something, we really didn't know what. But we knew something was happening. But by the time the war actually, by December 7th, it had calmed down. I guess we thought the politicians had solved all their problems, but typical they hadn't.
Actually, I had been in the sick bay that morning, and we had getting breakfast, and we heard bombs or planes coming over. And we didn't think too much about it because from time to time planes would buzz the harbor until we looked out the port and we could see big red meatball on the bottom of the wings. And then we knew they weren't ours, and the older sailors around knew they were Japanese, and it didn't always take long for the word to get around that we was under attack by Japanese. And from there it got pretty hectic. The Nevada got underway, and she tried to get out of the harbor, and they hit her right in the channel going out of the harbor, and they had a young officer on the con, on the up in the conning deck there, and he gave them orders they run to ground to keep the channel clear. Pearl Harbor is probably not one of the best harbors for defense. Everything I've ever heard was that you got a front door, you want to have a back door you can get out of in case of an attack. There's no back door at Pearl Harbor. There's just the front door. And if that channel is blocked, nobody gets out. And he knew that. So he run the Nevada up on the ground, kept the channel open.
I think that when I become the most fearful was hearing explosion in the distance. We talked about it, and somebody, we weren't the first ones out, somebody said that's the Japanese are picking the ships off as they come out of the harbor. And I know we was about ready to go.
The surprising thing was that I was not afraid at the time. You know, you think with people shooting at you and bombing, you would be. I think after it was all over, you got to thinking about it, you might show some fear. But I never saw anybody act as a coward that day. Probably 1,000 fellows at Wheeler Field that day, and everybody was trying to help.
Then I started helping with a bunch of wounded at Hickam Field, I remember that. And they laid them out in a triage system in which there were three different rows of them. One was light wounded, which did not need medical care at that time. Then some were wounded pretty bad that the doctor thought he could save. And then some were dying, of course, and I helped with the dying. We had one doctor and one corpsman that was just working only on those that were bad wounded that they thought they could save, and a bunch of seamen like me just doing the best we could with others.
You've been listening to Voices from South Dakota Survivors of Pearl Harbor. We continue our conversation on this 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor with Dr. Sean Flynn. He's professor of history at Dakota Wesleyan University in Mitchell. Dr. Flynn, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Great to be with you.
Let's start by putting this in perspective as far as how something like this could have happened. Take me back in time and sort of paint a picture to help clear that up for me.
Sure. Let me begin with a comparison to establish a frame of reference for the listeners and maybe help us all appreciate the shock of Pearl Harbor 75 years after the event. By way of a comparison, on 9/11, in the midst of our shock and horror at the events of that day, we were drawn to a comparison that the attacks in New York City and in Washington, D.C., and the hijacking of the planes were our generation's version of Pearl Harbor, this diabolical surprise attack on our fellow citizens and on our way of life by rogue actors. And in the case of Pearl Harbor, the rogue actors were Japanese militarists who had rejected the laws and customs of international relations. They had rejected, renounced the rules of war and engagement. In the case of 9/11, it's Al-Qaeda terrorists who are rejecting basic fundamental principles of humanity, and that is you don't target innocent civilians. Now, granted, the Japanese in 1941, 75 years ago, were targeting a military installation in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. That was, from their perspective, projecting American power into their sphere of influence. So we have to be careful to avoid making too direct of comparisons between December 7th and 9/11. But in both cases, at Pearl Harbor and in 9/11, we were stunned into denial that such events could occur to us. You know, events, those are events you read about in history books. Events like that don't occur to the United States. So it's necessary, and it's a good thing, I think, that every December 7th and every 9/11 we take pause and we ask, how could we have been caught off guard? You know, why were we caught off guard? How were we caught sleeping? Why were we caught sleeping? I'd ask your listeners to just place themselves for a moment in the minds of U.S. government officials, high-ranking military officers, and for that matter, the average American on December 7th, 1941. We could not accept the probability that Japan would be reckless enough and foolish enough and irrational enough to wage war with the United States. And we persist in that notion, we persist in that thinking, even though the Japanese had in 1904 conducted a sneak attack against the Russians. In 1931, they had invaded Manchuria. In 1937, they had invaded China. In 1940 and 41, they had invaded Indochina. So they had this pattern. They had developed this pattern of these reckless, foolish actions, but we remain convinced as Americans that if the Japanese were to test our resolve, it would probably be in the Philippine Islands, or it would probably be a sub-attack, for instance, on Pearl Harbor, or maybe Japanese agents on Oahu would sabotage our ships or sabotage our planes. But the idea, the prospect of an aerial attack against Oahu, well, that was impossible. It was a contingency. It was a possibility in the sense that we had planned for such an event, because that's what military planners do. They plan for every possible attack that could be attempted by the enemy. But it was not a probable thing. Mm. And we have to remember, in 1941, from the president on down to the most anonymous individual, our attention is facing eastward. Europe is under the heel of Hitler. Great Britain's isolated, reliant upon the United States for aid. the Soviet Army is reeling in front of the Third Reich's war machine. We're involved. A lot of Americans don't know, in the summer and fall of 1941, we're involved in a low-intensity shooting battle with the German Navy in the Atlantic. And we assume, as American citizens in 1941, that if we are drawn into war, it will be drawn into the war in the Atlantic and in the European theater. So we grow kind of lazy. We kind of grow kind of sloppy in our outlook towards Japan, and we begin assuming that, you know, we can manage events in the Pacific, that we can, that the initiative is in our hands and it lies with us. And that was a mistake, because the Japanese took advantage of that distraction and seized the opportunity in like only the Japanese could.
It's a large scale attack. It's not a small thing. How do they pull it off tactically in the Hawaiian Islands like that?
Yeah, it's audacious. You have to steam undetected across the Pacific Ocean, and you have to pick a sweet spot in the Pacific Ocean, which is a vast ocean, by the way. I mean, even this task force of six aircraft carriers is just a little bitty dot on the Pacific Ocean. So it's a big ocean, but you have to find this sweet spot in the northern Pacific between the Aleutian Islands and Alaska, or excuse me, between the Aleutian Islands and Hawaii, where you hope you can evade any kind of reconnaissance aircraft, where any merchant ships may not identify you and report you. So you have to get this aircraft carrier task force there. You have to maintain radio silence the entire way. You have to refuel in the middle of the ocean, which is no easy logistical matter. That's very complicated, and refueling in rough seas in December would have been a very difficult thing to do. Then you have to get these carriers undetected on a longitudinal line north of Oahu, close enough you can launch, you know, what would amount to 350 planes, measure the fuel capacity, make sure that they could get to their target, carry out their bombing runs, torpedo runs, et cetera, strafing runs, and then get them back to the aircraft carrier without running out of fuel and crashing. It was from a purely strategic and tactical point of view, it was a brilliant operation, and we did not believe the Japanese were capable of it. You know, we had this ethnocentric attitude toward the Japanese that they simply did not have the capability to do that. That technologically speaking, they didn't have the capability to use aerial torpedoes at Pearl Harbor. An aerial torpedo needs about 90 in 1941, and needed about 90 to 95 feet of depth in the harbor, so that when it porpoised, when it hit the water and it dove down, it would have enough room to level out and run toward the target. We figured, well, if we haven't invented a torpedo that can do that, certainly the Japanese haven't, because they're inferior to us in terms of their culture and technology. Well, in fact, in August of 1941, they designed this torpedo that will allow them to carry out the attack. Their pilots are professional. At this point in history, at this point in the Pacific War, their pilots are the best pilots. And they're capable of flying at a low altitude, hull level, dropping these torpedoes, and which caused damage to so many ships that day. But we just discounted, we underestimated them as an enemy, and the cultural gap, we just didn't take that into consideration. There were American officials who were warning military officials and warning the White House that, you know, these are a modern samurai people. They're committed to the Bushido code. They're committed to the sneak attack. They're committed to the surprise attack. They're committed to stealth. And they will risk suicide or a national form of suicide if they feel they can carry out a surprise attack at the heart of the enemy fleet. That's what a ninja does. They seek to strike at the heart of the enemy and do something unpredictable. And we simply couldn't grasp that, or simply didn't want to grasp that possibly could be translated into a modern conventional attack using this samurai gamble, if you will, this samurai audacity, and use conventional weapons to carry an attack straight to the heart of the Pacific Fleet.
As we remember 75 years after the attack, we also really remember 70-some years of peace with Japan. So with that attitude that you described to me, it seems that that's also very significant, that we've come to the point today with Japan as an ally.
Yes, And of course, at the end of World War II, the Japanese Constitution was written. They became a democratic nation. The emperor lost his medieval-like monarchical power. Japan was demilitarized and democratized. And our rebuilding of Japan, especially our commitment to the economic recovery of Japan, has endeared, in a way, I think, the Japanese to the Americans. And our during the Cold War, our commitment to defend Japan against the Soviets or against the People's Republic of China is something that I think has created an alliance between the two countries. And that's why I think President Obama's trip to Hiroshima or President Abe's trip to, or Prime Minister Abe's trip to Pearl Harbor, which he's going to take this month. These are symbolic gestures which have meaning. We don't want to forget what happened. We're not going to sweep history under the rug. That would be a mistake, and that would be disrespectful to those 2,400 Americans who died at Pearl Harbor. But at the same time, it's a signal or a sign that while we don't forget those things, we move together forward in peace as allies.
Sean Flynn is professor of history at Dakota Wesleyan University in Mitchell. History is remarkable indeed. Dr. Flynn, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, and have a great day.
You too.